communities.
And the people who say NIMBY, 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 they don't live right next door to it.
On the next Reveal.
Curious about the histories and mysteries of Bay Area cuisine? Well, KQED knows all things food, from recipes to guides on the buzziest bites in the Bay. Visit explore.kqed.org and you can explore all things Bay Area food. You're listening to KQED-FM San Francisco and to KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento. It's 11 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Newsday on the BBC World Service with Rob Yang and Sana Safi.
The former mayor of Mexico City, Claudia Sheinbaum, is set to become the country's first ever female president. We'll be going live to the capital as a vast crowd of supporters await a speech from their candidate.
The final tally from South Africa's election show that the country is also at a historic turning point as the ruling ANC, the party of Nelson Mandela, loses its majority after 30 years in power and calls on other parties to work with it. We will look at the potential coalition combinations.
And it is 75 years since the publication of the book 1984. We'll take you to a Russian city where people are turning to George Orwell for inspiration.
And Chinese tourists are on track to spend nearly $1 trillion at home.
Hello, I'm Neil Nunes with the BBC News. Exit polls and early election results in Mexico indicate that Claudia Sheinbaum will be the country's first female president. The former mayor of Mexico City is backed by the outgoing president Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Ms. Sheinbaum's supporters have already begun celebrating.
We have the first president, woman. In all of 200 years, only had men, but this time, for the first time, we have the first president, woman.
This is a historic night for Mexico. This is the first time in more than 100 years of Mexico's democracy to have a woman elected as the highest ranking server of the government, a woman. So it's a historic moment.
Ms. Sheinbaum's main rival, the conservative businesswoman Xochitl Galvez, told her supporters to be patient and await the official results. The election campaign has been marked by unprecedented levels of violence. More from Will Grant in Mexico City.
From the moment Claudia Sheinbaum threw her hat into the ring for president, the polls always suggested she would win comfortably. If confirmed, Ms. Sheinbaum's win would be a resounding endorsement of the social programs of the outgoing president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, which have helped pull millions from poverty. However, this election will also go down in Mexican history as its bloodiest. Candidates have been killed and intimidated from the very start of campaigning to voting day itself. When the political violence of this vote is combined with the everyday criminality of the drug cartels, the task ahead of the next president is daunting.
China has accused Britain's intelligence service MI6 of recruiting a couple who worked for the Chinese government to spy for the UK. The man's been identified only by his surname, Wang. There's no word from Britain on the case. Here's Laura Bicker in Beijing.
The Ministry of State Security claims MI6 spies cultivated a relationship with Mr. Wang and arranged dinners and tours for him while he was studying in the UK. The report adds that Mr. Wang had a strong desire for money and was offered large sums and security if he served the British government. It's alleged that after espionage training, MI6 ordered Mr. Wang to return to China to collect information related to the Chinese government. Beijing and London have long traded accusations of spying.
The BBC has seen evidence that suggests a Bulgarian woman who went on the run 7 years ago, accused of cryptocurrency fraud, may have been murdered. Ruja Ignatova, known as the Crypto Queen, is on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. New evidence suggests a notorious Bulgarian criminal offered the CIA information about her alleged killing before he himself was murdered. World News from the BBC. Some news, Justin. While we've been on air, the Mexican electoral authorities say their rapid sample count of results show that Claudia Sheinbaum has won the presidential election with between 58 and 60% of the vote. Economic activity in Nigeria is expected to face disruption today as public workers begin an indefinite nationwide strike over failed negotiations on a minimum wage. Unions have called on those in the health, banking, aviation and other sectors to stop work until further notice. The government has said the strike is illegal. One of the biggest annual pride parades in the world has taken place in the Brazilian city of Sao Paulo. Hundreds of thousands of people adorned with rainbow-colored tutus and dancing to loud music took over the central district. Many revelers wore yellow and green as part of a campaign to reclaim the colors of the Brazilian flag from the political right. Chaka, a drag queen, was one of them.
Look how sensational it is. The yellow and green is for everyone in society, not just exclusively for the bubble of right-wingers. That's why today we're definitely showing the world that green and yellow is already on the rainbow flag, and you can wear the colors of the rainbow.
A couple from New York who were magnet fishing in a lake are celebrating after they pulled out a safe that had $100,000 in cash inside. James Kane and Barbie Agostini had tossed a fishing line with a powerful magnet attached to the end of it into a lake in the Queensborough on Friday. The New York Police Department said they couldn't detect any crime attached to the money, so the couple were allowed to keep it. BBC World News.
Thank you for that bulletin of news. Hello, you're with Newsday from the BBC World Service with Sana Safi and Rob Young. It's great to have you with us. We hope you're doing really well this Monday. Coming up this half hour, Mexico is set to get its first ever female president. That news just confirmed in the past few minutes, but it was after a very violent campaign. We'll bring you all the latest from Mexico City. We'll also get the update on that other election we've been covering in recent weeks in South Africa, as the governing African National Congress, the ANC, the party of Nelson Mandela, has lost its majority and is looking to form a coalition. We'll find out what that might look like. As ever, your thoughts on that and all the other stories we're covering, always welcome, of course. Send your text and WhatsApp messages to +44 77 86 20 50 85.
As you have been hearing, confirmation is coming in. Claudia Sheinbaum is on course to become the country's first ever president, Mexico's first ever president, female president rather. The former mayor of Mexico City is backed by the outgoing president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Voters have also been choosing all members of Mexico's Congress and governors in eight states, as well as the head of Mexico City's government. The campaign has been overshadowed by violent attacks, which the government says have resulted in more than 20 local candidates being killed across Mexico, although private surveys put the total at 37. Let's get now more with BBC's Mundo, Daniel Pardo in Mexico City, and he's joining us now. Daniel, we are seeing on the screens the stage is set and we're seeing people with flags, and I can imagine it is a very lively atmosphere there. Mexico is set to have its first female president. Describe to us what you are seeing.
Very lively until just a couple of minutes ago, because in the past, I'd say 3 hours, we've been in a rather paradoxical kind of atmosphere, because on the one hand, you had exit polls saying that the difference between Sheinbaum, the government's candidate, and Xochitl Galvez, the second candidate, was about 20 to 30 points of difference. But at the same time, you had the opposition saying that those results weren't real and that they were not conceding the victory for the officialist candidate. So all the celebrations that were prepared for this big victory of the first female president are just about to take place, because there was a delay in the announcement of the results, and because there's this idea in the opposition that this is not a democratic election.
Tell us about the winner, Claudia Sheinbaum.
Claudia Sheinbaum is a physicist, and she's very different to the current president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, in the sense that she comes from a different background. She comes from academia. She's studied abroad. She studied in the United States. She has a PhD. She's an expert in engineering, in climate change. So she's like the typical technocratic, as opposed to the current president, who is the typical, you know, politician in Mexico. She was also the mayor of Mexico City, and she had to go through the pandemic, in which she showed her scientific understanding of things and how she uses data to resolve things. And now she has become president by a huge margin. She comes into power with a huge legitimacy, and she's pretty likely to be able to continue the policies that AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has been able to implement, and that most Mexicans, by a huge majority, support.
Speaking of the policies, this campaign was very violent. Will this be one of those priority issues that she will have to deal with?
Well, it's a tricky one. Violence in Mexico has been in place for decades. And to solve that, you need more than political willingness, right? And because most of these killings of candidates that took place over this campaign had to do with very local things, not things that had to do with the current central government, but things that have to do with, you know, the power, the influence that criminal groups have in certain areas of the country. So that said, Sheinbaum has said she had a very good or successful policy in terms of security during her government in the city of Mexico. She was able to implement policies regarding using data, intelligence, and putting cameras all over the city. And that did reduce crime and homicides and assaults. Problem is, in the country, it's very difficult. This is a very fragmented territory in which power of the central government is not always guaranteed. So it's going to be difficult for her to implement those policies, but she has that willingness to tackle it with that scientific knowledge that she has for all her policies and policies.
Daniel Pardo in Mexico City, thank you very much for joining us.
And we're going to play you some sound from a video feed we are getting from Mexico City. The man on stage talking to many, many thousands of supporters of the governing Moreno party and of Claudia Sheinbaum. They're waving Mexican flags, flags of the party. And after that, official confirmation that after a rapid count, the authorities have said that the ruling party, the ruling coalition, is the winner. They are waiting for Claudia Sheinbaum to talk. If she comes on stage and we're able to bring you her speech, we will do so in this hour of the program. Well, we're going to head to that other big election we've been following in recent days in South Africa, where final results have given the governing African National Congress 159 seats in the 400-seat National Assembly. It is the first time since the end of apartheid 30 years ago that the ANC has lost its majority, although it is still by far the biggest party. Well, mismanagement, corruption and insecurity have been named as some of the reasons that so many voters turned their back on the ANC. Well, a case in point is the severe water crisis in the coastal city of Durban, where the taps of thousands of families living in the townships around the city have run dry. Nomsa Maseko reports.
For many tourists, South Africa's coastal city of Durban is a spectacle of fine sand beaches and palm trees. But this city is also a place where thousands of residents struggle to find clean drinking water.
The problem is we don't have water for at least 20 to 30 days, and there's no drinking water. People are really suffering.
Logan Munsami lives in Verulam, a suburb on the outskirts of Durban where taps have run dry.
There's a lot of people, that's not only just me, it's more people, that's it's like elderly people. How do an elderly person come out from the house to go to the tanker? That's not even right by the house to collect water. And people are really suffering there.
Residents here have to rely on mobile water tanks to fill up all kinds of empty plastic containers. But the unreliability of the service led to life-changing injuries for Logan.
So when I ran to the tanker, I ran barefoot, not realizing the tar was hot. So I burnt my legs underneath and it picked up gastric gangrene. And the only best option they had at the hospital is amputate my legs.
The shortages have been blamed on mismanagement and alleged corruption by the governing African National Congress. But the party has repeatedly denied these allegations. In May, Water and Sanitation Minister Senzo Mchunu announced a multi-million dollar water treatment project which he said would solve the problem in this area. But now that the elections are over, residents want real solutions, not more unkept promises.
2 years back, we were getting water, but now for the last 10 months, there's nothing. It shows you that the problem is just getting worse. It's not improving in any way.
Vikash lives in a concrete house perched on top of a hill, overlooking overgrown greenery.
I come to do so. It's easy.
He shows me the tap in his kitchen, opens it, but nothing comes out.
Nothing, not a drop. But in this election, I've changed the party. I've been voting for the DA, because I did give the guys a chance by voting ANC, but it doesn't seem to be helping in any way.
Vikash is not alone in his decision to vote against the ANC because of the party's inability to solve the water issue. 43-year-old Monica Monsami also lives here.
We need that running water in our taps. I used to vote for ANC, but not anymore. There's a lot of things that we want, that we hope MK will do better for us.
Umkhonto weSizwe, the party that has proved to be the most popular in this province, has said the water scarcity problem is its top priority. Tamim Khize speaks for the MK party.
In fact, for the entire community, we need to bring water closer to the people so they get water. So we'll take care of all that. We've got a lot of water. We've got Umgene, which is the main supplier of water. We will deliver that, on the people so that they get their water.
With seismic changes happening in South African politics, residents here remain hopeful that their voices will finally be heard.
The BBC's Nomsa Maseko there reporting from Durban, and we'll be returning to the situation in South Africa later on in the programme.
And let's take a break from politics. Let's go to sport. Isaac Fennin is here.
Now, we've known about this news for a while. Kylian Mbappe has apparently signed his contract joining the recently crowned European champions Real Madrid. That is what our columnist Guillaume Balaguer is reporting. He verbally agreed to move in February and is expected that Real will announce that deal this week. Germany coach Julian Nagelsmann said that he is shocked that a public broadcaster asked participants in a survey if they would prefer more white players in the national team. The poll by ARD said 21% of respondents agreed with the question. Nagelsmann said that he agreed with his midfielder Joshua Kimmich, who described the poll as racist. Novak Djokovic is back in action at the French Open. He'll be hoping his match against Francisco Cerundolo won't be as long as his last game. He ended up playing Italy's Lorenzo Musetti until 3 a.m. in the morning on Sunday. A couple of excellent games in the women's draw too. Fourth seed Elena Rybakina takes on Elena Svitolina, and second seed Aryna Sabalenka plays the USA's Emma Navarro. I'll have more for you a little bit later on.
Perfect. Thank you, Isaac.
You're listening to Newsday from the BBC with Sana Safi and Rob Young. A reminder of our main stories this hour. The Mexican electoral authorities say their rapid sample count of results show that Claudia Sheinbaum has won the presidential election with between 58 and 60% of the vote. We're going to get some business news now, and Nick Marsh joins us from the business desk in Singapore again. Hi, Nick. And we're going to talk about some data showing that Chinese tourists are on track to spend nearly $1 trillion on domestic travel this year. That is more than they did in 2019 before the pandemic. It's a huge amount of money.
Yeah, it's a really huge amount of money, Rob. I mean, when we talk about China being an economic powerhouse, these are the kinds of figures that we're talking about. And that's why 3 years of zero COVID was so damaging. You know, you couldn't travel. There were constant lockdowns. If you remember, you had to test every few days just to leave your house. You know, that's a lot to recover from, you know, just from an economic point of view. But now we have this data from the World Travel and Tourism Council showing that people in China are really making up for lost time when it comes to travel, and they are set to spend even more than before the pandemic, like you say. The interesting thing, though, is that they are staying inside the country, partly because it's hard to get visas to some destinations, partly because it's just cheaper to keep it domestic right now. International flights haven't all fully resumed, so they're all still pretty expensive, and people want to, you know, go to different provinces. You know, China's obviously a huge, huge country, and that's going to add up, according to these new figures, to nearly $1 trillion being spent domestically, which even for a country the size of China is a lot.
And so people opting to stay in China when it comes to holidaying then. What about people going the other way? Is China attracting a large number of foreign tourists?
On that front, no. Things are actually very different to the way they were before COVID. Foreign tourists are at around half of the pre-pandemic levels. Again, I mean, there's no exact reason, but it's difficulties with the visas. You know, on a practical level, to visit China, you need all kinds of apps and payment systems that are unique to the mainland. That could put some people off. Even really amongst Western tourists, there could even be the perception that China's not the friendliest destination given the political tensions. But it doesn't seem like that really is a priority for the authorities at the moment, especially given how strong domestic tourism has been and looks set to continue to be.
All right. Thanks very much indeed. Nick Marsh there at the Business Desk in Singapore.
We are staying near China. Big Brother is 75 this week. Yes, it is 75 years since the publication of 1984, the dystopian novel on the dangers of totalitarianism. George Orwell's message strikes a chord with readers around the world, nowhere more so than in Russia, where the state is busy silencing dissent and the country waging war on its neighbour. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg travelled to the city of Ivanovo to see how some Russians have turned to Orwell for inspiration.
Drive 4 hours from Moscow to Ivanovo and you will discover a most remarkable place. Nestled between Madame Juju's beauty parlour on the one side and an off-licence on the other is a tiny library. And hanging outside is a portrait of George Orwell. Librarian Alexandra Karasiva shows me around the George Orwell Library. It was set up after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine as an antidote to propaganda and a reminder of the dangers of totalitarianism. There are books here about Stalin's terror and the crimes of communism. There are dystopian tales by Bradbury, Kafka, Zamyatin, and multiple copies of Orwell's 1984. Alexandra explains why.
The situation in our country now is similar with the situation in 1984. Total control from the government, from the state, and total control from the security structures.
One other similarity, the manipulation of reality. On state TV here, Russia's invasion of Ukraine is presented as an act of self-defense, occupation as liberation, reality inverted. Just as in 1984, citizens are told that war is peace and ignorance is strength. Alexandra believes that in such an environment, the library fulfills a vital function.
Helping our citizens to find the space of freedom in our unfree country.
In your library, you have lots of books, historical books, books about Lenin and Stalin, dystopian novels. How can books help Russia today and Russians today? Can they help?
These books show our readers that the power of autocratic regimes is not forever, that every system has its weak points, and every person which understands properly what is the situation around him can preserve his freedom. And freedom of brains can give the freedom of life and of country.
These books are not banned in Russia, but the subject matter is sensitive. Honest discussion of Russia's past or present can bring problems. And problems they have. The local businessman who was funding the project has fled abroad and is wanted by police. And there's another issue. The library doesn't have many visitors. A dystopian future. Few in Ivanovo seem worried. In the town centre, it's a big band, not Big Brother, that's drawing a crowd. People are dancing in the sunshine to classic Soviet melodies. Some here embrace the direction in which Russia's moving. We're growing more independent, pensioner Vladimir says, less reliant on the West. We're making progress, says a young lady called Natalia. As Putin says, for Russia, this is a new stage. But what about Russia's war in Ukraine? I don't watch anything about that now, Nina says. It's just too upsetting. Back at the George Orwell Library, Alexandra breaks some news to the handful of visitors. The building's been put up for sale. The library has to move out. Immediately, one woman offers use of her van to help move to temporary premises. Other people suggest ideas on how to raise money. This is civil society in action. Admittedly, on a tiny scale and with no guarantee of success. But they're not giving up. Not yet.
Steve Rosenberg reporting there.
We're going to take you back to Mexico City. Our top story is that Mexico has elected its first ever female president, Claudia Sheinbaum. You can hear her there addressing supporters in the capital, Mexico City. She says that the opposition candidate, Galvez, has called her to concede, and she says that she will become the first woman president in Mexico's history, promising the crowds, "I won't fail you." The speech is in Spanish. We don't have any translation simultaneously, so we'll keep an eye on what she's saying, and we'll bring you updates later on in the programme. Now we're going to talk about something which I have not yet tried as a sport. It is fishing, not with a net, but with a magnet. Now, normally these metal detectors, their finds are pretty small. But James Kane and Barbie Agostini recently went magnet fishing at a lake in New York and pulled out a safe with about $100,000 in cash inside. Well, Kane has been telling our colleague Andrew Peets that although he'd managed to snare safes before, he knew quickly that this one was different.
All magnet fishers eventually get some safes, and I only felt different about this one when I saw the hole. I was trying to bang it on the floor to get the door open, so I saw the hole in the end of the other side of the safe, and I put it down back on the floor, and I saw something that looked like a long row of baggies. Sometimes when you find safes, you find little baggies. I guess that's where they stored coins or money or IDs or something like that. And I reached in with my hand, and in my brain, I'm like, oh no, this can't be happening.
And what was your reaction, Barbie, when it was not only a safe, which is quite an exciting find, but you could tell that it had got some money in it?
At first, I didn't believe it. I thought he was joking around or over-exaggerating. When he first told me, he's like, oh, it's money. I'm like, no way. No, it's not. No, it's not.
Were you able to just count it? Is it in good enough condition to just be able to, you know, think how much have we got here? Or did you have to go through any kind of process to make the money safe and able to be used?
The money is actually so waterlogged, it is not usable at all. The NYPD couldn't even take it in as evidence. We did call into the police because in New York City, when you find something like that, you have to let official know, or you could actually be in trouble if you take something like that. But it's very waterlogged. It's the size of money, but it's just almost like a mushy pancake.
So you've been allowed to keep it, but are you going to be able to take advantage of it? Is the money going to be usable? Are they going to reimburse you for the cash?
Not right away. In Washington, D.C., it's where they have our Bureau of Engraving and Printing, where they create the money, and it needs to be handed in by person or in mail, which I really don't trust mail, but we're going to hopefully bring it to them, and it could take up to 3 years, but they will rebuild every single bill. The American money will be rebuilt, and they will cut us a check.
So one day, Barbara, you are going to be wealthy. Have you started spending it in your head yet?
Yes, I have. I keep thinking of little things here and there, different ideas I can spend it on.
Barbie and James there talking to Andrew Peach. This is Newsday.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the U.S. is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content. APM, American Public Media, with support from Progressive Insurance. The Name Your Price tool provides a range of coverage options. Progressive.com, price and coverage match, limited by state law.
People in Copaig, New York say they support green energy.
We are not climate deniers, nor are we NIMBYists.
But when a developer wanted to install thousands of solar panels, people in town were up in arms.
Most people in this community just want this thing to go away.
Rural America pushes back on solar projects on the next Reveal.
And we'll have the next Reveal coming up for you tomorrow morning at 1 o'clock here on KQED.
Hello, you're with Newsday from the BBC World Service with Sana Safi and Rob Young.
Election in South Africa. Final results confirm that the ANC has lost its majority.
Mexico officially has its first female president. Claudia Sheinbaum is currently addressing supporters in the capital.
And the missing crypto queen, the woman behind the OneCoin scheme, may have been murdered. But first, the news.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. The Mexican electoral authorities say that Claudia Sheinbaum has won the presidential election with between 58 and 60% of the vote. She'll be the country's first ever female president. China has accused Britain's intelligence service, MI6, of recruiting a couple who worked for the Chinese government to spy for the UK. Beijing claimed that British operatives convinced a man with the surname Wang to defect along with his wife. The BBC has seen evidence that suggests a Bulgarian woman who went on the run 7 years ago, accused of cryptocurrency fraud, may have been murdered. Ruja Ignatova allegedly persuaded millions of people to invest in the bogus OneCoin scheme. South Korea has said it's suspending a military agreement with North Korea. It comes after hundreds of balloons carrying rubbish were floated from the north into South Korean territory. South Korean groups have adopted similar balloon tactics to float leaflets and South Korean pop music into the north. President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine is in the Philippines, where he is taking part in a ceremony to open his country's embassy. He thanked President Ferdinand Marcos for agreeing to take part in the Swiss Peace Conference on Ukraine. Syrian state media say a number of people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes near the northern city of Aleppo. A British-based war monitoring group said the strikes killed pro-Iranian fighters. Palestinian media are reporting a series of Israeli airstrikes on refugee camps in Gaza during Sunday, in which they say about 20 people were killed. And a couple from New York who were magnet fishing in a lake are celebrating after they pulled out a safe that had $100,000 in cash inside. Police said there was no way to identify the original owner, so the couple can keep the money. BBC News.
Thank you, John, for that summary of the news. Hello, you're with Newsday from the BBC World Service with Sana Safi and Rob Young. Hope you're doing well today. Coming up this half hour, the election results in South Africa, food shortages in Sudan, and a BBC investigation into the woman once known as the missing crypto queen, who may well have been murdered. We'll get the latest on that from the presenter of that BBC podcast. Your thoughts on all of our stories welcome, of course, by text and WhatsApp to +44 77 86 20 50 85.
We start with South Africa, where the ANC, once led by Nelson Mandela, has been hit by the worst election result since apartheid ended 30 years ago. South Africans are now this morning waking up to the party having lost its majority in the National Assembly for the first time. In his first comments, President Cyril Ramaphosa says, "Our people have spoken whether we like it or not." The centre-right Democratic Alliance remains the second largest party with 22% of the vote, while the new MK party led by ex-president Jacob Zuma is in third place with 15%. Here is the reaction of some young people from Johannesburg upon learning of the election result.
I hope the ruling party is shaken as we want them to be because, well, we need facilities, you know, in the rural areas. Where I'm from, in the Eastern Cape, there's a whole lot of stuff that is not done, you know, like roads, like basic needs, man, like your toilets, your, you know, water. We just need the basics, like just take care of the people. And the third would be for them to stay on their promises, to keep their word, you know.
So ANC, their part is over, but they're still running us anyway. So it's not up to them for us to improve. It's up to us to see it for what it is, as the youth, to say, you know what, I need to improve myself. Because at the end of the day, government is government, you know. So us, as the people, we need to find ways to survive, to live.
I'm very much optimistic that, like I'm saying, if we get somebody young, fresh, young blood, yeah, I'm very much optimistic. It's going to be a beautiful country.
Young South Africans reacting there to that news. Our correspondent, Catherine Bierhanger, joins us from Johannesburg. Now, Catherine, this is a huge loss for ANC, and they've got a lot to deal with, haven't they?
They have a lot to deal with, and that's because that official announcement of the election results set off a deadline, a two-week deadline for the first sitting of Parliament. And that first sitting, the president needs to be elected by members of parliament. And as you mentioned, the ANC, Sana, no longer has a majority of seats in the House. And that means they have to come up with either a coalition government or some kind of power-sharing alliance with other political parties in order to be able to re-elect President Cyril Ramaphosa and also make sure that its political agenda does pass through the House. So what we know is happening now is that there are lots of conversations, phone calls, text messages happening between different political parties. Some, like the Democratic Alliance, the second biggest party in South Africa, has set up a special committee led by one of its former leaders, Helen Zille, to begin these negotiations. The Inkatha Freedom Party also has a similar team that it's put together. And so what we're going to see is the negotiations between the parties, but also conversations within these political organizations, because they would have to go through different structures, different chains of command. Some of them will have to vote on any final decision that's made. That's challenging because, of course, any political party is a broad coalition of different interests, different views. So it's not a guarantee that if an agreement is reached, any of the parties would agree to it and vote it through.
And how are people reacting to this? Because this is likely to take some time. As you say, negotiations are underway and possible options are being discussed. How are people thinking this is going to impact their lives?
Exactly. And we heard in some of those voices there, people are watching how their politicians, how their political leaders that they have voted for are going to handle this historic moment for South Africa. Remember that there are around 18 political parties that have been voted into the House. They all have different kinds of policies, all the way from populist left-wing policies onto the right of the political spectrum. Now, how you get all those parties to work together, parties that have been at loggerheads, see each other as enemies, that is going to be a challenge. But also remember that South Africa has gone through political transitions before. It's made it happen. President Cyril Ramaphosa has been urging political parties to come together and work for the good of South Africans. So that is the big challenge. People here are demanding better leadership, better governance from their political parties.
Catherine, thank you very much. Catherine Bierhanger in Johannesburg.
Well, we've had loads of text and WhatsApp messages in on the election results in South Africa. Joe, listening in Ghana, says the election in South Africa has ended peacefully, so let the feuding party soften their stances to help form a coalition with the ANC to ensure peaceful governance. Martin, listening in Juba in South Sudan, says he's not surprised that ANC lost its majority, saying the political failures were written all over the Rainbow Nation. Certainly the government of national unity should be possible. Harold in Uganda says the ANC must undergo a rigorous and thorough reform and renewal and reinvent the party, including, he says, electing new leaders in order to once again earn the confidence, trust and support of the majority of South Africans. And BW Bokri, listening in Freetown in Sierra Leone, has a wider message. He says, congratulations to the people of South Africa. You've exercised your democratic rights. I hope the electoral process in South Africa will serve as a lesson to the ruling and opposition parties in Africa. The ballot box is the only means of effecting change. Thanks very much indeed for all of your thoughts. Now, all of this week, we're going to be focusing on Sudan and the threat of famine there as the war continues to rage. The country's been at war for more than a year since fighting erupted between the paramilitary rapid support forces and the Sudanese army. Thousands have been killed, more than 9 million have fled their homes, and about 18 million people are already acutely hungry, according to the United Nations. That is 40% of the country. We got this update on the food shortages from this listener in the capital, Khartoum, who tells us that people are starving, not just because of a lack of food, but because it has become too expensive to buy.
Hello, this is Ahmed from Khartoum, Sudan. 2 days ago, my wife returned to our home in Omdurman North after spending a month with her parents in Fetihab, an area in Omdurman South fully controlled by the paramilitary rapid support forces. Before she left 4 weeks ago, I gave her enough money for at least 2 months of food. However, on the second week, she called via Starlink and asked for more money because they ran out of food. The money she received via phone bank was not also easy to cash. A 20% commission was taken. I was so surprised on how quickly she ran out of money and asked, "What did you do with the money?" She said nothing, just food is so expensive here. The price is increased by 400%. The only food available is smuggled at a higher price from SAF-controlled areas as well as from south of Khartoum. Once she returned, she described more on the food insecurity in the RSF-controlled areas. She said most of the neighbors that did not leave their homes only eat a meal a day. Sometimes they don't. Many are thinking of leaving, including her parents who insisted for 14 months not to leave. This situation was not like this a few months ago when looted food from factories in Khartoum Bahri were available and sold at less than 20% of market value, but that's no longer available. This is the case in most of the RSF-controlled areas in the capital. Food has become so expensive and rare. A very small number of people can afford to buy what's available. Hundreds of people queue from the early morning a few meters from where I am recording this audio, waiting for lentils as a breakfast. Some of the people add more water to the lentils so they can eat it during the night time. The dependence on food kitchens are increasing daily, both in SAF and RSF controlled areas. The queues are getting longer day by day, more kitchens being opened, and the quality of the food is going down to meet the growing demand of people. The funds are also becoming harder to get. Humanitarian aid rarely reaches the SAF-controlled and the RSF-controlled areas, but the SAF-controlled areas have some food. Throughout the 14 months I spent in the war zone in the Sudanese army control areas, I saw only 5 times aid being distributed to people. Yesterday morning, I came across 8 bags put on sale at the local market. The bags were full of wheat flour, sunflower oil, sugar, tomato paste, lentils, and rice. Despite the reservations, many here tend to buy aid at the local markets in order to save money in case war lasts longer. My friend Suleiman, who lives in RSF-controlled area of Mayo, south of Khartoum, sent a message on WhatsApp last night requesting financial assistance because it has become impossible to survive in that part of Khartoum due to food shortages. Suleiman said the two food kitchens in his populated neighborhood no longer have funds. Even if they get food, is not available at the market due to the food ban by the army. He said volunteers running the kitchens thought it would be best to use any new funds to provide buses for people to leave, as the worst is yet to come if the food shortage continues.
That was Ahmed there, one of our listeners in the Sudanese capital Khartoum, there, on the desperate situation there is in many parts of the country when it comes to securing and affording food. And we'll be returning to that situation every day this week here on Newsday.
Now, Maldives President Mohamed Moeiz has announced that it will ban Israelis from entering the country as public anger has increased over the war in Gaza. Nearly 11,000 Israelis visited the Indian Ocean's archipelago last year, which was 0.6% of total tourist arrivals. For more, we are now joined by Ali Wahid, a former tourism minister for Maldives. Thank you very much for joining us here on Newsday. What do you make of this decision by the government to ban Israeli citizens?
Thank you very much. I think it's a decision of the people of the Maldives, and we believe it's the right thing to do. The world has been watching and doing nothing, to be exact to the point, because more than 36,000 people have been killed in front of our eyes, and I really support the decision of our country people.
What do you think prompted this decision?
Beheadings of children, killing women and innocent civilians. More than 36,000 people, we have seen the numbers from BBC and other news outlets, have been killed. And there's no justification to these actions by Netanyahu and his government. And it has to be stopped. It has to be stopped immediately.
But wouldn't you agree with some people who would say that the citizens of Israel who want to spend their money and they go to the Maldives to have some time, that is not counterproductive? It's far better for people to visit and exchange ideas than ban them, especially in times like this.
During this time of difficult decisions the world needs to side with, I think we, as people of the Maldives, are siding with the principles and the just right thing to do. We are not blaming the citizens here, but I believe Maldives, even though we are a small nation and while we depend on tourism, we at least got the guts and courage to do the right thing. If the bigger countries and the powerful nations stopped it beforehand, we wouldn't see beheaded children's bodies all over the news. And I think there has to be a starting point, and I really appreciate the people of our country standing up. Yes, it will have an impact on our industries, especially tourism, but the turbulence we will take forward, because people who want to visit our country are more towards doing the right thing. And I think the right thing is everyone to just say, stop it, we have had enough.
When is the ban likely to be implemented?
The ban will be implemented as soon as the legalities are completed. And right now, there is a bill proposed by our party, Maldivian Democratic Party, to the parliament, and the government is also in agreement. So it's a decision unanimously agreed by the people of the country. So it's not a political decision. It's a decision more towards the principles and belief of the people of our country.
You say it's not a political decision, but what we have been reading is that opposition parties are pressuring the government rather than the public.
No, opposition or government, we represent the people. If you look at the will of the people of our country, we are a 100% Muslim country, and these kind of things that we come together, there is no one that opposes in our country. I don't see anyone who is called a Maldivian opposing this decision, because we keep on talking about terrorism and blaming terrorism just towards beards. But what Netanyahu and his country, or his government especially, his forces are doing is pure terrorism in broad daylight. And this has to be stopped just in the name of taking on Hamas. You cannot kill children and women. You cannot keep on doing this. And we can't justify what is right or wrong by taking on guns and missiles. Only diplomacy should prevail. And that's what the people of Maldives is calling for.
Ali Wahid, a former tourism minister for the Maldives. Thank you very much. We have had an Israeli MP earlier on this issue.
You're listening to Newsday from the BBC with Sana and Rob. Reminder of our main headline this hour. Claudia Sheinbaum has been elected as Mexico's first ever female president. Addressing her supporters in Mexico City in the past half an hour, she promised continuity with her political ally, the outgoing president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and also vowed to reduce violence and improve the lives of women in a country with one of the world's highest rates of femicide.
And now let's go to Isaac Fannin, who has all the sports.
It looks like Kylian Mbappe's move to Real Madrid will be announced this week, according to BBC Sport columnist Guillaume Balaguer. In an article on the BBC Sport website, he says that Mbappe verbally agreed to join the newly crowned European champions back in February, but he signed the deal until 2029, which will earn him $16 million a year and a whopping $163 million signing bonus, which will be paid over 5 years. Elsewhere, Germany coach Julian Nagelsmann said he is shocked that a public broadcaster asked participants in a survey if they would prefer more white players in the national soccer team. The poll by ARD said 21% of respondents agreed with the question. Nagelsmann said he agreed with his midfielder Joshua Kimmich, who described the poll as racist. Nagelsmann said his team will play for all of Germany. Let's talk tennis next. Novak Djokovic will be in action at the French Open on Monday, taking on Francisco Cerundolo. The world number one came through a five-set epic against Italy's Lorenzo Musetti. That match finished at 3 a.m. in the morning on Sunday. It was the latest finish in French Open history. Here's Djokovic.
There's beauty as well, I guess, winning the match as well at 3:30 a.m., you know, if it's the last one of the tournament, but it's not. So I, I'm going to have to switch all of my young jeans and try to recover as quick as possible.
In the women's draw, one of the games of the day sees fourth seed Elena Rybakina taking on Elena Svitolina. Rybakina hasn't dropped a set so far this tournament, but she's going to face a tough challenge against Svitolina, who has a 2-1 winning record over her opponent. Golf next, Japan's Yaka Sasso recovered from a three-shot deficit to become the youngest player to win two US Women's Open titles going into the final day. There had been a three-way tie involving Australia's Minji Lee, American Andrea Lee and Thailand's Wanchini Mi Chai, but Sasso stormed back with four birdies from five holes on the back nine to snatch victory.
Well, I think I was hearing my drivers really good. I don't think I've missed a lot of fairways today. I putted really good. I switched to this new putter, Odyssey. I've been putting really well with that, and I think that helped a little bit as well. And you know, I think just stay patient and enjoy playing golf.
And we had a thriller at the T20 Cricket World Cup as Namibia beat Oman thanks to a super over. The match was tied after 20 overs, 109 runs each. And in the super over, David Wissa and Gerhard Erasmus hit 21 runs for Namibia, with Wissa bowling out Nassim Kusi during Oman's one over at the death. Head to bbc.com/sport for all your latest sports news.
Isaac, thank you.
We were hearing earlier on from one of our listeners in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, Ahmed, telling us about the desperate situation when it comes to securing and then indeed affording food. Chatham, who's listening in neighbouring South Sudan, says it is very sad news to hear Khartoum is like that. It is usually a place that welcomes guests so warmly. And Celestine, listening in the Gambia, says, how on earth are bullets cheaper than food in Sudan? This is a serious crime against humanity. Thank you for all of your messages today on Sudan and on the situation in South Africa. Now we're going to return to a story we have covered periodically over the years. It is the case of the woman who became known as the missing crypto queen. Well, the BBC has seen evidence that suggests the woman may well have been murdered. We're talking about Ruja Ignatova, who is on the FBI's 10 most wanted list after persuading millions of people to invest in one coin that turned out to be a bogus scheme. Well, an investigation by BBCI and the BBC programme Panorama suggests her close links to the Bulgarian mafia may have led to her downfall. Well, we're joined now by Rob Byrne from the BBC podcast Missing Crypto Queen and has been investigating Ruja's disappearance for 5 years now. Welcome to the programme. Just remind us who she is, was, and what OneCoin was.
Is, was is the crucial question, really. That's what we've been investigating. She sort of burst on the scene in 2014 with this cryptocurrency, and it was at a time when there was a huge amount of hype around crypto. A lot of people had made significant sums of money out of Bitcoin, early investors in that. So she sort of said, here's the next Bitcoin. If you missed out, invest in this. And yeah, I mean, it obviously, as you've alluded to, it wasn't quite all it turned out to be. It wasn't quite all that she'd promised. And, you know, we basically attracted millions of investors around the world, at least $4.5 billion of investment. And that's gone. And she's gone as well, along with, you know, a lot of the money. Since then, some of the people who were close to her and involved in the scam have been apprehended. Some of them are even in prison now, but she isn't.
She disappeared. And have we any idea where?
Yeah, so, I mean, the last record of her was getting on a flight very early in the morning, leaving Sofia in Bulgaria, going to Athens in Greece. That was way back in 2017. And no one's seen her for sure since then. Obviously, we've had a podcast at the BBC that in 2019 started investigating her disappearance and sort of really unraveling the scam as well. And there had been reporting around the world in different places about it. But I suppose that story, kind of the podcast, really kind of brought that together coherently for the first time. And a lot of people got to know about it as a result of that. Yeah, and so we've kept looking for her, and in 2022, so quite a long time, you know, 5 years or so after she disappeared, the FBI added her to their 10 most wanted list, which was kind of, I think, probably the most significant development in the case since then.
And so what is the new information then that you have got that has led you to conclude that she may well have been killed?
Well, it's really down to her relationship to an individual that we knew about, a lot of people had told us about, and we have been able to bottom out that they were closer than perhaps we knew, and he played a more significant role in her life, possibly her disappearance, and possibly her murder, than we ever thought. And that's based on, basically in 2019, when US investigators were going after people close to her, including her brother, who kind of took over leading the cryptocurrency after she disappeared. And in some court proceedings, they allude to a big-time drug trafficker from Bulgaria being in charge of her security. Now, they never named that individual in those proceedings, but we've subsequently talked to a number of sources in this world, including a former IRS investigator they were investigating with the FBI into OneCoin early on.
That's the Internal Revenue Service.
Yeah, Internal Revenue Service, yeah. And you know, we now subsequently believe that the person that the US prosecutors were referencing in those proceedings was a guy known as Taki, who is widely suspected to be the head of an organized crime group. And a number of people have told us that that relationship between the two of them, between him and Ruja, was closer than we knew, that he was handling her security, that he was basically helping protect her. And, you know, it's kind of changed the complexion of the story somewhat since then.
And so she could be dead?
Could. Yeah, I mean, I'll let you...
Her adeptness at disappearing, we may never know, I suppose.
Well, that's the thing. It's very difficult to know fully. I mean, it's kind of all started. Sorry, there's a lot of like backstory to this, but
there are 11 episodes of a podcast.
12 now. 12 now. Yeah,
12 from today.
And essentially, this investigation, as we have it when we teamed up with colleagues in across the BBC, Panorama, BBCI, Investigates, and the World Service. And what kicked it off was a report by an investigative journalist in Bulgaria that had got hold of a secret police document in which it was claimed that Ruja had been murdered. And it was written by a policeman. An informant had overheard a conversation by someone close to Taki, who said that he'd ordered her murder and provided some sort of very sparse details about it. Now, we haven't been able to independently verify that claim. However, a lot of people in that world believe it to be true. And we are, on the balance of probability, the former IRS investigator, Richard Reinhart, thinks it's likely she's dead as well. So what we're doing is kind of unpacking that and seeing what supporting evidence there is towards that in this documentary and podcast.
Rob Byrne, thanks very much indeed. Well, BBC has written to Taki's lawyers and the Bulgarian government. They did not respond, and the prosecutor's office in Sofia says it doesn't cover up crimes and persons who've possibly committed crimes. This is Newsday from the BBC.
When Atlanta Philharmonic conductor Amy Wilson was diagnosed with a brain tumor, she fell just short of qualifying for insurance through Medicaid. Why hasn't Georgia expanded the program?
I feel like access to good, affordable health care should be a human right.
Voters like her will determine the presidential election. Our series, We the Voters, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition starts at 2 o'clock tomorrow morning and continues until 9 here on KQED. Increasing clouds. We'll have temperatures down to the low to upper 50s for tonight. Partly sunny in the morning, and highs will be reaching in the low 60s along the coast to the upper 70s well inland. And looks like a heating trend is coming our way. Tuesday and Wednesday inland could be close to 100 degrees. And good evening. I'm Steve Fox. You're listening to KQED-FM, San Francisco. And KQEI-FM, North Highland, Sacramento. It's 12 midnight.
Hello, and welcome to the History Hour with me, Max Pearson, the past brought to life by those...